2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 366, Christ and Culture in Conflict, The Gospel and the Homosexual. Participants, William D. Russell and J. William Nicholson.
Let me quickly introduce our speaker and respondent. William, or Bill, D. Russell is the husband of the former Lewis B. St. Lewis has two daughters, Lisa Russell and Shauna Russell Shields. He is a faculty member of Graceland University and is a professor of American History and Government. He has a B.A. in Religion from Graceland, a Master of Divinity School of Theology, and a J.D. from the University of Iowa College of Law. He's an elder and a Sunday school teacher and represented the RLDS Church of Christ Church for the state of Iowa on the Justice Commission of Ecumenical Ministry. Currently, he is a member of the RLDS Community Church. Anyway, yeah. Church's Peace and Justice Committee and Justice Coordinator for the Lamoni. Was a member of the World Church Commission on Races for 4 years and helped draft a document, their position on prejudice on race, ethnicity, gender. He has been president of the Mormon Historical Society, back in the John Whitmer Historical Association, editor of the John Journal, editor of Courage, a journal of history, also of Thought and Action, and he's been on the editorial board of the Restoration Studies, as well as Dialogue, a journal of thought, and several others. He has two books that have been published, Treasure in Earthen Vessels, An Introduction to the New Testament, and The Word Became Flesh, the New Testament text. Two books in the work, Repent or Be Destroyed, the 19 Cult Murders in Kirtland, Ohio, and From Sect to Denomination, The Fundamental in the RLDS. And the response will be by J. Williams Nicholson, who is a third-year graduate, philosophy, master's, and a couple of...
Thanks, Duane. Just one minor correction on my wife's name. It's Lois and not Lewis, but in the context of today, that shouldn't really matter. Normally, I begin by, you know, some really witty comment designed to set where the heresy starts to flow. But since this is a fairly serious, this is a serious topic, so again. Over the years, Graceland College has made the normal legal promises of non-discrimination, which are required by the federal government, if a college is to be eligible for any sort of federal aid. In our catalog, we promise not to discriminate on the basis of race, color, religion, age, sex, national origin, or disability. In 1944, philosophy professor Bob Mesley brought to the faculty meeting a motion asking the Board of Trustees to add sexual orientation to that list of categories. There was a fairly vigorous debate in faculty meeting. Two respected faculty members in particular argued against the motion. The essence of their argument was, we are an RLDS college, has traditionally seen homosexual conduct as immoral, so let's not. The faculty voted in favor of Mesley's motion by a very large margin, although an actual count was not taken. With such a big... The Board of Trustees seemed favorable to the idea, but chose to adopt instead a general statement that didn't mention sex. So later, the Alumni Council asked the board to reconsider that. Professor Mesley brought his motion to the faculty again in 97, hoping to get an actual counted vote, this information. It passed 48-8,
probably two-thirds.
Thus, 86% of the Grayson faculty voted in favor. The two LDS members of our faculty were among the eight no votes. At least four of the other six negative votes came from faculty in recent years joined fundamentalist RLDS splinter groups that have split with the Dean Women in 85. About half of the faculty are what you'd call Gentiles. So the RLDS and the Gentiles, one of whom happens to be Jewish, were almost 100% in support of the Mesley motion. The Board of Trustees accepted our recommendation, and since 1997, Graceland has legally promised not to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. This past year, Professor Mesley decided to float another proposal before the faculty. His new proposal was to allow homosexual couples to receive the same benefits that heterosexual couples receive. The main financial benefit of his domestic partnership policy proposal would be health insurance in case a partner employee be covered by Graceland. At this time, we have just one gay faculty, and I don't think his partner would. His motion would have approved the idea in principle, but then called for a discussion. This past spring, a vigorous debate between the two sides developed in the student newspaper and Tower. Faculty, students, faculty, and even one alumni got into the action and the debate. During the newspaper debate, the student body president, a very talented and popular senior, came out of the closet as a gay man in an article he wrote. When the faculty discussed the Mesley proposal, this new Mesley proposal, one associate professor of finance, collection of scriptures, I got very emotional in her statement of opposition to Mesley's motion. In deference to her, the faculty decided to delete the statement to support it in principle, but just have the same discussion in the act. It looks like there's a strong majority of faculty support the proposal. Once again, the opposition came from conservative faculty members who argued on religious grounds, almost always citing the Bible as their basis position. At one point in the debate, a fundamentalist biology professor noted that during the past year, the school's disciplinary council had punished students for various violations, crimes like theft, using drugs, or drinking or smoking in the dormitory. He pointed out that we do make moral judgments about personal behavior at Graceland, and we mete out punishments for such misbehavior. The gay student body president, who was a member of the faculty meeting by virtue of the president, was obviously annoyed. But he kept calm as he stated his objection, being compared with people who made choices in criminal behavior, like theft and use of drugs and so forth. Then he said very firmly, "I did not choose to be gay." And I suppose I know at least 100 RLDS gay and lesbian people, and I don't think there's a one who would not echo Michael Moraine's comment that I did not. Those who have opposed to gay rights proposals seem to see it as a matter of Christ versus culture. That is, they think the contemporary culture is pressuring us to give up our long-held moral principles regarding homosexuality and gain favor with a correct secular culture. I agree that it is a case of Christ versus culture, but I will argue here that the sides are reversed. It is centuries of cultural traditions rooted in prejudice that are being called into judgment of the vision of what it means to be disciples as Christ. The negative attitudes and stereotypes about homosexuals are the product of centuries of culture, of silence, and of prejudice. Those cultural biases, like some other prejudices, are unfortunately found in some passages of Holy Scripture. However, if we regard the life of Jesus of Nazareth as a lens through which we get a glimpse of what kind of lives God would have us lead, then we cannot continue to treat homosexuals with less than equal rights and dignity. We inherit terrible prejudices from our culture. I doubt if there's anyone here who was not raised to believe that certain people are less worthy merely by virtue of religion, their gender, their race, or ethnicity, or sexual, or some other category. Episcopal Bishop John Shelby Spong, one of my favorite writers these days, recalls that he learned these dehumanizing, unchristian prejudices in the church itself when he was growing up in North Carolina. Over a lifetime, he's found that the humble carpenter from Nazareth, who we call the Christ, has called him to love unreservedly, thereby breaking down those barriers. Christians who have defended these crippling prejudices like homophobia and racism have often been forced to rely on obscure biblical passages buried in the midst of some of the most unchristian ever written. But because those passages are in Holy Writ, we accept them. We should condemn them in the strongest terms possible. Just one example, I think. An example of an extremely wicked passage, a very wicked passage, is Deuteronomy 23:2. No bastard shall enter the assembly of the Lord until the 10th. I mean, what a despicable.
That's not what all your genealogical research.
I hope that's not part of the temple recommendation process or anything like that. But the teachings of our churches, highly influenced by culture, have taught us to regard gays as evil, as mentally diseased, as child molester, avoided. The churches spoke from an abundance of ignorance. Indeed, the first official statement that I'm aware of in the RLDS, and it's just embarrassing, couldn't distinguish homosexuality. It's depressing to read. But in those days, it wasn't discussed in the popular press. Mental health professionals thought it was reflected that. What is usually missing in these, what I call, biblical defenses of our prejudices, we should begin every consideration of what the scriptures say, what the church should be saying about any given subject by looking first as what the four gospels have. Shouldn't all other scriptures and all of our traditions be judged in the light of the life as we find in the four gospels? That should come before the rest of the New Testament, or the Old Testament, Book of Mormon, before the Doctrine and Covenants, certainly before any of my general authority. In his brief public ministry portrayed in the four gospels, Jesus regarded the outcasts of society as beloved people of God. He accepted and loved the lepers and other outcasts and announced the liberation of the oppressed as the central theme of his ministry in chapter 4 of Luke, where he said, "I have come to set at liberty those who are oppressed." And for us, one very oppressed people are homosexuals. The gospel of Jesus teaches us that love is the goal of human relationships. Human beings need to love and be loved. And while acceptance by the larger community is important, possibly there's no substitute for the emotional intimacy that two people can experience when they commit themselves to unconditionally love each other for the duration of their lives. And we can easily love our friends. Jesus tells us to love our enemies as well. But he takes us further than that. By his life, he told us to love those who are marginalized in society and forgotten. That's worse than being hated. I recall Elie Wiesel saying that the Jews in the concentration camps were not hated by the Nazis. They were below that. They were not even worth hating. They were nothing. Jesus loved the outcasts. They were not even worth hating. The power of love heals. Jesus' love healed people. Those who are loved are healthier. They heal more quickly. Your love can help have a healing effect on the lives of your gay friends. Don't be upset. Jesus condemned many of the behaviors of his culture, but in the four gospels, he never utters a word of judgment. The Hebrew prophets condemned many of the sins of their day. Aware of many of these, but but they never, neither is homosexuality condemned in the Book of Mormon
or in the Doctrine and Covenants.
Dwayne, something he wrote, they had a quote I really loved. The lesbian singer and songwriter and comedian Lynn Lavner observed, quote, "The Bible contains six admonishments to homosexuals and 360 to heterosexuals. This doesn't mean God doesn't love heterosexuals. It's just that they need more supervision." To be sure, the Mosaic Law in the Bible condemns homosexual acts and many other actions that we would call minor sins today as punishable by death. The law is filled with abhorrent rules. The Mosaic Law in the Bible is filled with abhorrent rules and regulations. No wonder the Apostle Paul said that Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, and all who rely on the works of the law are under it. The totality of Jesus' message suggests that homosexuals are accepted in God's sight on an equal. Wayne Schau just made the comment that we should be reading the scriptures in context, reading them holistically, pulling something from the midst of a book like Leviticus that's got the most surrounding. The strong condemnation of homosexuality in Leviticus may have occurred because the fertility cults which Israel condemned included sacred homosexual prostitution. Also, the frequent injunction in Genesis calling Israelites to be fruitful and multiply,
really
good at that, may have been a factor, but a society that needs population is not likely to be friendly to intimate human pairing, do not provide the opportunity for procreation. But now, the growing overpopulation planet leads us to that procreation greatly in importance. Those passages in the Bible which do treat homosexuality as evil should be thought of as coming from the culture. The biblical writers, understandably, did not question the assumptions of.
We rarely do.
So some biblical writers condoned slavery, approved of polygamy, couldn't conceive of the societies other than that in which women are seen as little more than property. When the New Republican Party, in its first national convention, condemned the twin relics of barbarism, soon to be RLDS President Joseph Smith could embrace those two platform planks because he recognized that polygamy and slavery were immoral, even though both customs. Young Joseph Smith no doubt realized that Christ's spirit of love and his sense of justice found both immoral. Not surprisingly, every party, the Republicans. In 1984, I attended my first Sunstone Symposium. In one of the sessions, a psychologist suggested that the church believes in love and lifelong committed relationships, as it says it does, and why does the church withhold its blessing on a relationship simply because people happen to be. I have two friends who became roommates at the university in 1904, and they've lived together ever since. They made decisions about their careers and where to live and where to retire and so forth, just as any married couple would. They've had a happy life. They're two wonderful people. Would you want to have been a person who told them 53 years ago, don't do it, find a woman and get married instead? If anyone quoted scriptures of silence, we can be glad that they didn't. I know the family of one of them very well. The family accepts Danny, but they are silent about the relationship.
No communication.
There should have been a gala 50th anniversary celebration 3 years ago. Instead, there was silence. They should be asked, Denny and Wally should be asked to teach a Sunday school class on relationships. Contrast this lack of public support or recognition to my situation. When Lois and I were married 4 years ago, about 175 people attended our wedding. At the beginning, Lois and I quietly entered the sanctuary.
Didn't have the
and we went through the pews, shaking hands and hugging every person. Some of you know, I know Paul Edwards. He's a special. Each person was a cherished friend or family member. These greetings symbolized our deep appreciation for the love and support. And this has haunted me ever since. Contrast this to the fact that most gay and lesbian couples are denied the opportunity to have any kind of public expression of love. And no ceremony, no 50th anniversary celebration. Instead, silence. I thank God that some RLDS homosexual couples I've known have had or soon will have commitment ceremonies, services of worship in which they express their love and desire to commit their lives to each other, a supportive community in attendance, just as we have in the tip. 2 weeks from now, Lois and I will be attending a holy union ceremony in Chicago. Many members of the Church of Christ will be there, the congregation, and an elder will be there. My brother Dave was an outgoing lad and the most spiritual of our four siblings. He was the one we thought would follow our father's footsteps and become a full-time appointee minister of the RLDS. From an early age, Dave struggled with his sexual orientation. He did the right thing and married and had three children. But I was puzzled when Dave, as an adult, did not seem to fit in at church, despite being called to at a young age, when you're called, if at all, and also an elder and church school director of a large branch while still in his 20s. But by the time he was 30, he dropped out of our church, attended about every non-fundamentalist Protestant denomination he could find, and after many years of struggle, he finally found a home among the Unitarians, possibly the only church in America fully. Think how unfair it is to the woman who wants heterosexual marriage and doesn't realize the nice man or woman they're dating is not heterosexual at all and probably doesn't feel safe to reveal that or doesn't recognize it, or whatever. Imagine how unfair it is to someone like my former sister-in-law to marry a person who discovers 15, 20 years later is homosexual. If our society allowed young men and women to be open about their sexuality, Dave and his wife of 24 years old at peak years. In a culture that teaches us to despise homosexuals, it has often been coming to the fact that a close family member, a good friend, is gay, his attitude. My mother would be traditional and very loyal, blindly loyal, I would guess. Her late husband, my father, had been a full-time salaried minister for our church. He was one of them there hired preachers we hear about. Mom was 81, and her son, David, when Dave came out to his mom, not everywhere else, but mother's 2,000 miles away. You don't have to tell her. But he did, and I real deep down, I realized. Many parents surprised their child by accepting this own or something. But anyway, mother totally. In fact, in the last years of her life at the RLDS, somebody made them pounce on him. But anyway, I would argue that the family member comes out and the family member recognizes, accepts. I think that's a road to Damascus of the heart, their lives. I have a friend whose son, our oldest son, packed his bags before coming out, ready to leave. They rejected him. But fortunately for him, it was accepted. But many parents reject. Here at Sunstone, a couple of years ago, a case where he was rushed to the hospital. His parents were notified. No wonder this. I think we all know gays who've come out of the... Most parents and many friends eventually, if not immediately, accept that they don't want them. And the reason we don't, we love them. And we know that Jesus loves them. The guest, Lois and I have attended several recent other activities of the RLDS called GALA, Gay and Lesbian Acceptance. And the guest ministers at GALA, apostles like Apostle Linda Booth, Dale Luffman, presiding at some other prominent church, attend to express their ministry. At these retreats, I renewed my friendship with some former students who are not only among the very best students I've ever had, but also the finest human beings. Many of them are or have been in the priesthood. To take away the calling, as our official policy calls for, is just an outrage. Find people whose ministry are peace to me. And so if church authorities should go after any of these, I will support my gays. I value them. The RLDS Church, has an official policy of silencing gays. But because I love my church, I will introduce a resolution at my stake and hopefully onto the World Conference asking to remove the statement on homosexuality handbook. Last year, I in capital against the World Conference adopted by margin. So in some jurisdictions, the policy on gays is ignored, thank God. I would suggest that in evaluating a person's fitness for the priesthood or a temple recommend, we should not be concerned about their sexual orientation at all. Rather, as far as sexuality is concerned, isn't the question whether or not they conduct the sexual part of their lives in a responsible manner? Thereby, we can have a consistent sexual ethic for homosexuals in which we value love or respect, lifelong commitment, monogamy, true partnership, monogamous relationship. On the other hand, we would clearly disapprove of exploitative or promiscuous relationships, whether heterosexual or homosexual. We should only raise the question of some conduct in their sexual aspect of their lives with the gospel. And we could have consistency. As individuals and as churches, we need to confess our sin of homophobia and repent from it. My church and your church, a justice on the highest court in Australia, Michael Kirk, said that when we treat gays as though they should be ashamed of themselves or evil, we carry a very heavy moral responsibility for crimes, the bashing, the denigrate, family rejection, the despairing exposure, and the lonely denial that inflict on us. So I mentioned at the outset of the introduction, it was mentioned that we adopted at our World Conference in 1992 on prejudice draft, repentantly acknowledges that we have hated homosexuals. The resolution affirms the love of God for them and a place they may find acceptance and opportunity to share their gift. The resolution did not specifically call for the ordination of gays, and he leaves the old policy, and left that implication. In that conference action, we took a small step toward repentance. I have a very dear friend, and I'm going to just briefly summarize. It's a very good friend who drifted away from the church, drifted back. His friend was really upset when he decided to come back to church and start dating women again. But pretty soon he recognized, my congregation accepts me, and so his partner. And pretty soon they ordained him, despite the fact the pastor is homosexual. I asked the pastor, he said to me, I said, did the regional administrator know that? I'm going to call him Keith. And she just said, I didn't tell him. We flew beneath the radar on this one. The pastor knew Keith is a wonderful Christian man. She loved him. She wasn't going to let a bureaucrat block divine calling. So she did what she knew was right instead of following it. So I've been thrilled that my friend, I just worry that possibly the church will pull the rug on find out. To claim, as the earliest church has claimed in the past, to be the one true church of Jesus Christ on earth, while at the same time being racist, sexist, homophobic, make a mockery of such a claim. It is blasphemy. No matter what denomination we're talking about, when we deal with the question as to whether we accept them before God, the question we are asking is, are we truly, or are we truly the Jesus Christ? If they are not treated a particular church in that regard, that church has fallen short of being any kind of
church. I know Dr. Russell chose not to make any jokes, but since now the conservative orthodoxy is about to flow, maybe I should make some jokes and put myself at ease. I'm very humbled to be here. This is an issue I've been thinking a lot about. It's been the topic of much discussion in the church where I'm from, and like in gay suicide there. I've been thinking through all sides of the issue, often as much as time and working on my thesis permit. I didn't actually know I was even going to do this until just a couple weeks ago. I was visiting Sunstone headquarters with Dan Wutherspoon, and I know he needs a lot of help, like a symposium, but I said I'd go ahead and volunteer to chair some things, and he said, well, would you like to present anything or respond? What are you responding to? Well, yeah, but don't get me involved in anything controversial. I prefer not to do anything on especially feminism and homosexuality. I'm kind of considering or thinking about a CES career, at least as a volunteer, and I don't want to be perhaps restricted to just handing out programs in the church or being a clerk if this got back, although I know that's highly unlikely. It was more of a joke than anything else, but he suggested this, and then he suggested he needed a conservative response for balance on this paper. All right, and I just kind of ironically grinned to myself because probably this is the only place I'd be regarded as conservative. I often refer to myself and my ward as a liberal Mormon and kind of look at it as an oxymoron, but at the same time they were curious and want to know what I mean by that. But I said, well, not as much as you might suspect. Basically, if I had to find it, when I'm in grad school with my atheist, agnostic, philosophical colleagues, I feel like Jerry Falwell. When I'm in my ward, I feel like Jerry Springer. I guess that's the best way to define what I am when I say I'm a liberal. But to expedite my responses, just in general, without coming on specific things, which I'll do a bit later, I think the biggest difference between our LDS and us is obviously the theology, but in the context of that, it kind of what hermeneutic we come to try and understand the sacred and how we privilege what I'll call the phenomenology of repertory experience and testing what true doctrine. Of course, from the LDS perspective, living prophets have a very strong normative role in interpreting Scripture and appropriating it to challenges of the day. Yes, it's true, Christ doesn't specifically condemn homosexuality, doesn't specifically condemn drug use. I think we really need a much broader hermeneutic in understanding what the true doctrines of Christ consist of. My first set of remarks will revolve around what I think is the phenomenology of heterosexual independence in the Judeo-Christian tradition. Yes, there is a lot more about heterosexuality and homosexuality. One simple reason is there's more heterosexuals, and perhaps there's a lot more ways to err in that. But also, it seems to be, to me, and from an LDS perspective again, the model of personal relationships, the ideal of how we do establish eternal families. This is even more true in LDS eschatology, I think. I think from a mortal point of view, there's a lot of justification you can give for complete homosexual inclusion in a Christian ethic. But in the LDS perspective, there might be some reason, I think a lot of reason for privileging heterosexual of homosexual. One thing that occurs to me is the special phenomenology of metaphor in sacred texts. I'm not just talking about Adam and Eve, not asked Eve. I'm talking more about things like the imagery and things like Hosea, where Christ is likened to a husband, a covenant, a wayward wife that's cheats, but is which is a metaphor for idolatry, but then is restored to the covenant with forgiveness. In the Judeo-Christian tradition in Judaism, the Kabbalah, something I've studied under my ordained rabbi professor, all of it in the mystical sense about heterosexual union. In the New Testament, we have, of course, Christ being likened to a bridegroom, church, a bride. And in the Doctrine and Covenants, we have Zion referred to, gendered as she, and Christ as he. At the very least, I think this gives us a strong clue, if you'd grant me that, that there is a kind of privileging of heterosexual interdependence, the model, if for no other reason, then that's how posterity comes into the world. I think it's even more emphatic in the LDS endowment, these temples. Okay, so that's the first set of remarks. Moving on to the second. This is where the disagreements become more stark and probably trenchant. To begin with, I want to make some remarks on the primacy of charity and love. And the personality of Christ is kind of a litmus test for understanding what the gospel really amounts to and what a Christian community ought to be. Quoting two things Dr. Russell says here, however, we regard the life of Jesus and that as a lens through which we get a glimpse of what kind of life God would have us live, we cannot continue to treat homosexuals less than equal dignity. The part I want to comment on is the life of Christ as being an adequate lens to understand how we should be comport our lives, what all of God's commandments are. I think it's inadequate as a lens in and of itself, by itself. Another point here, shouldn't all other scriptures and all our traditions be judged in the light of the portrait of Jesus we find in the four Gospels? Here is an LDS believer and modern revelation, the emphatic no. That's inadequate as well. And even on its own terms, if you look at all of Christ's saying, he didn't always just preach love. It wasn't solely what he's about. There were the Christian virtues, courage, temperance, honesty, to mention a few that are mentioned throughout the scriptures. But he also says he's come not to set peace on the world, but become as a sword to set man and father at variance against each other. So there's a sense in those scriptures, those are in Matthew, that there's a sense in which the gospel can divide. And unfortunately, we do see that in some rejections that he's mentioned. Now, I'm not trying to be, don't misunderstand me, I'm not trying to say that Christ teaches not fully accept and love people as people, but there's a sense in which there's divisions because of what the standards of the gospel require. Some people may not meet those standards. Often, I think, with most homosexuals, through no fault of their own with respect to mortality, and I'll get to that when I talk about how we might be accommodating what I would refer as righteous homosexual unions. But I think it's important, at the very least, to understand that love is not the sine qua non, the sine qua non, to use a Latin term, of the fullness of the gospel and the message of Christ. There's more to it, even by the lights of Christ's own sayings. Okay, third set of remarks. Again, this is the doctrine of the spirit of revelation. I interviewed two RLDS converts to the LDS church before I came down here, and it was most interesting what they had to say. I realize most of your remarks are a plea to LDS to change our ways, because you don't have temple in your church, I understand, and you don't have an endowment. Yeah, and there's not an eschatology, or it's minimalistic. And frankly, if that's the case, I'm not quite sure why you haven't ordained gays already. Seems like it should have already happened. Because I really believe that unless you really buy into eternal perspective of eschatology about what Christ's gospel amounts to, there's lots of different ways you can understand the justice and the mercy of God. To such an extent that there wouldn't be any kind of special requirements that would ever exclude gays from any of the liturgy of participating in the Mormon faith. But I think there's good reason to think that there's differences that should be made as far as privileging heterosexual in a certain way, heterosexual relationships in the eternal family. Let me just say a couple things. I want to leave time for... Well, I got it done in 8 minutes. That's amazing. Wrote a lot more. I guess the debate over the place of charity in the Christian message of salvation, like I say, is just one part of where the difference is between LDS and RLDS. It seems that RLDS theology is kind of a limited. It privileges gospels in a certain sense, and everything else that they don't like, it kind of gets, well, that's cultural bias, attention to that. I think in LDS eschatology, especially with the harshness of something like the Mosaic Law, and things like that, if it's just looked from a moral perspective, it's monstrous. Talking to my thesis chair, an ordained rabbi, they don't view God as being unloving because of that. The very harshness there in order to preserve the ultimate ends of God's plan of salvation. Also, it needs to be understood in the current time, which is a really harsh time. And oftentimes, if one's had children, sometimes some harsh punishments are called for in order to ensure the efficacy of God's purpose is being fulfilled, especially post-mortally. So their justification, especially, you need an internal spectrum, especially to understand things like the sacrifice and a lot of other things. It's hard, I think impossible to construct theodicies for unless you have a robust eschatology and a concept of the totality, say, of God's commandments, the fact that they're instrumental in achieving a certain type of goal, a certain relationship, which is defined, in my view, by the revelations on your eternal family. Okay, but given all this, what would I view as a moderate conservative orthodox LDS about accommodating what I previously referred to as righteous homosexual relationships, where, like Dr. Russell says, there's commitment, there's fidelity, there's lots of Christian virtue, there's great gifts they can bring to the church. Certainly, I think Christ's gospel mandates that we accept and understand the challenges they have in our culture. I was going to. I know a lot of what Dr. Russell said was about his gay friends. I do have not as many, perhaps, gay friends. One of which has been able, through a very supportive set of bishops, to marry in the temple, and he has a wife. I'm talking to him. I'm sure he still struggles at times, but he says he's happier. I can't say that's the case. Every homosexual. I was going to say, you know, some things about my experience as homosexuals that made me try, on one hand, defend LDS orthodoxy and yet preach a gospel of charity and understanding. I know the word homophobic is thrown around a lot. I find most of my peers in my church are more like homo ignorant or homo insensitive. It's not that they're really malicious. They just don't think through these things, don't want to. They don't want to think about it anymore. They want to be with people who smoke or drink. But if you get their ears, if you read about the plight, they show some sympathy, and maybe that's all they do. They don't think about it. I've thought about it a lot. I thought about what Edward Kimball had to say about a possible second track. It seems clear to me from my studies of homosexuality that, and they're limited as they are, that it's not a choice. I agree with Dr. Russell. Whereas it seems the preponderance of brethren think it's a learned behavior, although some things that Dallin and other things they say privately indicate they're more aware of the complexity of the matter than that. But at any rate, if there's going to be an accommodation, it seems that to the fullness of, say, the priests in the temple, the extent that the priests in the temple ordinances presuppose that they're a kind of preparation for heterosexual marriage and family, there's going to have to be some sort of revelation to clarify or modify. It seems that so much of what goes in LDS discourse, both official and unofficial, at the cultural level, has that view of marriage and family. So the idea of committed, righteous, same-sex unions that have these virtues, these Christian virtues Dr. Russell talks about, have to be somehow accommodated by, I would think, some extra revelation. I'm hopeful something might happen. I'm very much unhappy with what seems to be the homo insensitivity in most of Deseret Mormon culture. But I was raised in the Midwest, so let me tell you, it's different in a lot of other places. I think it's better. But I'm not sure what would happen. I can't be sure what would happen. I pose Edward Kimball the question. If the two-track theory works, he seems to still think there might be sanctions, at least in terms of priesthood or serving as their calling. That's tough. But whatever happens with respect to mortality, to those people suffering through no fault of their own with a culture, a Christian culture that doesn't try to understand them and with limitations of service in the church, I do believe with J. Reuben Clark that, and Elder Packer, you know, is not the most popular name to mention here, that these things will be overcome. Does that mean that somehow same-sex unions will be sacralized at a level that they'll permit a celestial glory? I'm skeptical. I don't want to rule it out. But I definitely think that God factors with things like, and to the extent that homosexuals do the best they can to live the gospel, their crowns may shine much brighter, certainly brighter than many, many unfortunate Orthodox Mormons that look on them fear and derision. Thank you.
Okay, we have 15 minutes for question and answer. We need the questions placed into the mic so that the tape gets it picked up. And we'll have to have people walk up here most of the way.
I was just struck by two different points. For you, there was a great deal of sensitive response to your friends. You had learned from your friends. I was struck by your comment that you had gay friends, but I didn't have any kind of, that you'd ever opened your ears. Perhaps you have, but I'm saying in what you presented. Also with it, I was also struck by you had a great deal of, a little of this and a little of that, but it didn't seem to me that your understanding of the gospel at least had fit together in any kind of full understanding. It was very much piecemeal, very much lacking a sense of historic development, something that maybe had been said 400 years ago in a different context was still applicable now, even though the context would have changed and possibly changed it, would change its meaning intensively, and that you were very much a part of the, when I was younger, perhaps this is the difference, age, when I was younger, to talk in church about many, and I notice now in the vocabulary of the church, I haven't heard many. In years, we've narrowed the vision as to what is acceptable to a very, very small, this has got to be what God wanted, everything else, all the other mentions, basically we're living in a spiritual Levittstown, but I'm most distressed by the way in which your friends, there was no feeling that you'd ever listen to it.
Well, I don't take his aggression in scriptures or testimonies to be normative for what the revelation at the comp to understand it. As far as the brethren, nothing I've said, everything I've
I was looking for.
I felt a lot of your.
I'd like to know.
And do they stand outside of. Or is there a real.
Why?
By length of things, about this.
I was just going to say, I think homosexuals have a very big responsibility in this, too. We're always sitting around saying, poor us, why don't you understand us? I think part of the problem is we're not educating anybody. We take so long to come out and learn to love and accept ourselves, and then we expect everybody else to be there, too. And they haven't even begun the journey, and we can't expect them to have made the same journey we have, feel the same way we do, and understand it the way we do without some education. Case in point, when I finally told my mother, she said, well, Terry, I always thought you were homosexual, but I never dreamed you were gay. Well, you see, I'd never educated her, so she didn't know the difference. And I think we have to educate people, too. And I congratulate you for starting this trip. I mean, I wouldn't want to start 2 weeks ago to explain something to this group. No, thank you. I think you've done very well.
Thank you. My question is for Bill Russell. In studying your church over the years and the changes and development that it's undergone, I noticed that when it was no longer tenable to believe that Brigham Young begun polygamy, that you gave up that pillar of your belief. Likewise, when it was impractical to think there would always be a successor in the Joseph Smith lineage who was capable, you gave up that pillar. Having given up those two pillars, I noticed your evolutionary position on the non-literal necessity of believing in the Book of Mormon, your softness on the Word of Wisdom. My question is, do you think in forging this new liberal scholarly identity, the community of Christ, that liberalization and total acceptance of gays in your sacraments and ordinances is another move or manifestation of the liberal new scholarly identity that you're taking on as a church? Could this be an opportunity for another evolutionary step in that liberalization? And even so, to the extent that there may be a gay apostle in the community of Christ someday.
The issue of polygamy is sort of, you know, the resonate and it wasn't about it. It's a very self-centered run down the line. And I just offer leaders in tribute break down.
When you're talking about homophobia being a fear, I find I teach junior high, and the male students that I have a definite fear that they may be homosexual. That is a homophobic thing. I think what we're practicing is heterosexism, which says, I am this way, I know this is right, therefore you must be this way or you are wrong. And heterosexism is a huge, huge problem, just like Americanism in Africa is a huge problem. You have to adapt in order to love and to get along and to share yourself with other people. And to be heterosexistic is wrong. Can you respond to that?
I certainly agree that if heterosexuals shouldn't think they have a monopolist on virtue or even the virtue in sexual intimacy. I mean, even the conservative brethren are moving more about the idea of a privilege of marriage relationship as far as qualification for certain celestial glories. If you're just talking for equality with, I thought I made this clear, equality and love and tolerance and acceptance and even admiration of the virtue homosexuals possess from heterosexuals within the moral perspective, yeah, great, I'm all for that. I didn't think I said anything inconsistent with that. But if you do take the revelations about the family and about posterity, which is something homosexuals can't do by themselves, seriously, and if you do have an understanding of what I talk about, phenomenology of sexual difference and glorification post-mortally, then there's a disqualification that happens with homosexuality. I don't think that's any more sexist or biased than someone not getting to law school if they don't meet certain standards. Now, maybe something will change post-mortally and we'll have a revelation about how homosexuals will be glorified. I can't rule that out. I won't rule that out because I believe in contemporary revelation, but, you know, I'm skeptical about it. But certainly, I mean, in terms of, and the brethren maybe not are kind of talking in faint praise about homosexuals are good people like President Hinckley did at the San Francisco Examiner and not giving them the type of, what would be the word, oh, credence or whatever, that I feel he ought to. I think they're moving in that direction. Of course, they're old men, a product of their time, but I certainly feel they've been of great integrity that really are concerned, but obviously they have as their priority in a public discourse championing a certain type of relationship they think is ordained by God. So
we have time for one more question.
I'm once again struck by the gap. Exaltation requires supposedly marriage and family. So what is the church giving?
I agree with you. I so hope that will change. I mean, I agree.
Well, then, how are you, what are you going to do?
What am I going
to
do?
Encourage.
I'm not an apostle. What do you want me to do?
To help encourage that change.
How can I encourage that change?
You as an ordinary
I'll tell you what I do. What I do is very unpopular. I mean, the reason I had these Sunstone articles is when I heard about the gay suicides and the things that led to them, the kind of rhetoric, the homophobic or very anti-gay rhetoric in the BYU paper and some other things, and how that was really kind of a catalyst to this kind of despondency by Stuart Mattis. I mean, I read this in the halls of the church right outside sacrament meeting. I mean, that's pretty bold where I come from. Mesa's not much different than the Salt Lake Valley. He was responding to a lot of different things, irrational hatred of homosexuals. All right. You want me to come out as a closeted Mormon liberal? I would have voted no for that. I'm just glad I wasn't faced with that dilemma, huh? In Arizona? Yeah, they know. Off the hook. I'm using some Milton Mormon moderate.
Just one comment here, and my question to you would be, why are you glad that you weren't faced with that dilemma? Why would that have been a dilemma? Wouldn't you have voted for what was right rather than what the brethren happened to be, their policy, which you're critical of?
The dilemma,
why wouldn't you vote for your own conscience instead of, you know,
I would have, inadequate? But the dilemma was because I am honest with my peers in church about it. I know how they'll probably view me with suspicion. And that means I'll have less influence. That means I'll be a clerk the rest of my life. That's the dilemma we face when you want to be a militant moderate with a liberal sympathy. I don't know what to call myself.
You're a brave person.
Thank you very much. Yeah.